Richard is in deep conversation with Neil now, talking about soundscapes, etc. So I thought I'd come over here to do with both Ed and Emma. Emma, your thoughts so far on the whole package?
It's very interesting. Me and Ed were just discussing how long perhaps these portraits would take to do and how you know when you're finished. Like, how do you know you don't have to add an extra bit?
The old sort of final routine.
And I just reacquainted myself with Henry Purcell, the portrait of the former organist of Westminster Abbey, and I didn't know he'd only lived to be 36 years old. But of course, this is another thing. We're seeing what we consider to be quite young people, but at the times they were painted, this is probably approaching sort of the end of their lives. And also I'm going to be asking Neil about the frames as well, and how important they are, and whether we should be as excited about the frame as what's in it.
One thing about Richard Fitzwilliams, we know Richard, we could just leave you to go the whole thing and he'd be still talking 4 or 5 days later. Time is obviously
it's simply, here we have Charles I. It's not one of the famous ones, but it's just looking at portraiture and what portraiture can say about an individual down the ages, looking at the Stuarts around the walls, and also looking at the fact that one of the things that I'd like to mention is the National Portrait Gallery has, and I wish other galleries had, it has notices. If you want to read about the different portraits, you actually don't have to stoop down and prostrate yourself on the floor to be able to read the various histories. And if you look and read the histories in this room, and there's Archbishop Laud, for example, and there's the Duke of Norfolk and various other members of Charles's court, and also the Cromwellians, what you find very often is that they met a very unhappy end. But if you can read it, at least it is at a level where a reasonable person doesn't have to stoop down, and it really is so important, Neil. I mean,
absolutely.
Are you going to keep it like that?
Well, and access is very important, isn't it, to museums generally, you know, about making sure that, you know, that there is interpretation and that people can come here and there's information, because we know that visitors want information. Sometimes we do exhibitions where there's very scant information because the photographer or whoever doesn't want it and wants to keep it minimalist, but actually our visitors, you know, especially if they're paying money to go and see an exhibition, they like to have captions and interpretation, not necessarily loads of it, but, you know,
just an indication in terms of what it is. So it's an informed
version. You can't read the captions, because I've been, even the most recent, this is a brilliant exhibition, it's a Waddesdon bequest at the British Museum in a new gallery, and it is very, very impressive. But if you want to read what's in the central cabinets, you will have to bend down at rather odd angles. And what I'm hoping is that you will assure me that you will be keeping these levels. And also I'm interested to know why these levels were chosen and kept. And yet in most other exhibitions now, you're finding the National Maritime Museum, even Tate Britain sometimes, you get this experimenting with them, so that you really have to bend down at odd angles.
Well, I know that in Tate Britain, they had a marvellous rehang of their permanent collection, a walk through British art or something like that.
Oh, but it is, yes, it's
and
impressive.
It's wonderful, but they have made a very conscious decision to put their captions sort of just above the skirting rail, but they didn't, they wanted to have this idea of pictures singing without, you know, on their own space, so they wanted to have a big gap between the captions and the
classic audience author text. You decode the structure from the image.
Could one not say that, you obviously a designer, anyone who's curating an exhibition will naturally have different ideas, and it's only right this should be so. You don't want something static. But equally, when an experiment fails, it can be very uncomfortable for those individuals who are keen to read more about the persons or whatever is being depicted. At least, you know, if you want to know more about it, there would have been at least something else in the gallery to make that.
Smartphones, QI codes. That's all I have to say.
That's it. You know, but that's the thing with phone apps and with, you know, museums are doing more and more of that, aren't they? And audio guides and things.
And it was certainly something which, as we continue sort of wandering along, we certainly thought that with the website we mentioned, there is an awful lot of information. So maybe, as I say, that's a way in which the 21st century is being adopted and taken on board, that people actually bring their own portable material in there. Not to download your campaign, Richard. I still support it, obviously. Ed, you had a little question for Neil about the frames, I believe.
I did. I mean, here we all are looking at what's on the canvas and everything. Yeah. But, I mean, how excited should we be about the frames? And are these the original frames?
A lot of them are, and we have, and it's the same with lots of museums and the Royal Academy and so on, they have framing departments where the fitting of the portrait or picture to the frame is taken extremely seriously. I mean, look at this one right in front of us. Some of them are incredibly ornate.
So I think that's almost OTT, really.
And we get that. And then there's one of, we've got Handel in the room next to us where you can see his violin in the frame and all sorts of musical iconography in the frame. So, but we do try and, if possible, keep the frames contemporary with the painting. We acquired recently a magnificent self-portrait of Van Dyck, and it's as magnificent as the painting itself. It's this extraordinary oval frame, auricular frame, because it's got all sorts of interesting sort of heraldic elements around that frame. You can't really imagine that portrait without that frame. It's beautiful, but
when paintings arrive here, I mean, apart from the obvious thing of the period in where you place them, but I mean, would you move other paintings around a room like this, say, to accommodate the best lighting for a particular one?
I mean, the basic hang in this gallery is a chronological one. So you'll notice you go up the escalator, you start with the oldest, and then you work your way down. And I think people do want to find their way round, especially because you're telling the story of Britain through its portraits. But that's not to say we don't change things around. And in fact, in the autumn, we're working with Simon Sharma, who's going to be doing a television series, where we're having, probably for the first time, a thematic hang of a lot of our portraits. So five or six of the rooms in this gallery will be looking at portraits through the themes of power, love, self, people. And in the self, you'll be able to have the opportunity to see Joshua Reynolds' self-portraits next to Mark Quinn's self-portrait of him as a frozen blood head, of his own head made of frozen blood. So that contrast is something very exciting, and you'll be able to see portraits that you've normally seen perhaps in the context of other paintings of its age, talking or in dialogue with self-portraits from 200 years later. So that's going to be very different.
It's nice to hear that Simon Sharma and presumably the BBC are once again following in the footsteps of Southside Broadcasting and Siren FM. Emma.
Yeah, no, I think it's interesting what you were saying about the different themes, because a lot of these paintings do have a lot of character and a really strong theme. So will you then be mixing up the periods and stuff like that as well?
Yeah, so for example, we'll have Robert Browning, and is it the Elizabeth Barrett Browning,
it is,
is that right?
Yes.
And with John Lennon and Yoko Ono in the same room. So it's going to be like that. And
Paul McCartney wouldn't be happy about that, but what the heck?
And Elizabeth I with Margaret Thatcher. So, you know, they'll go, and then perhaps you'll have Amy Winehouse with
Janis Joplin.
Yeah, but also, not British. You know, because, you know, the first celebrities, people like Sarah Siddons, you know, they sit nicely in a room with an actress of today, you know.
The 20th century was very much a visual century, insofar as prior to that we obviously had portraiture, we had the mass media that was coming into to play with the 20th century. But of course in the early days of portraits, a lot of folk don't realise, as Ed pointed out earlier, that we have areas like Charles Dickens, they only have their portraits done when they were in their successful period. So we just see them as in their elderly years. Now it's much more of a chance to actually see people as they kind of grow and develop.
Absolutely,
Prince
yeah.
Harry, for instance.
Yes, absolutely, yes. So, in fact, we've acquired Jason Bell's christening picture of Prince Harry. So, there's a long tradition of royal portraiture, and lots of photographs and paintings have come into the gallery, and a lot of the public enjoyed those
pictures.
I'm just
waiting for the first royal selfies, I'm sure they'll be
The Queen has sat for, I think it's 134 portraits, beginning with de Laszlo at the age of 8.
So it's two a year.
It is an amazing number, but royal portraits are particularly fascinating, I think, because at a period, and I'm looking back over the last 30, 40 years, when it was considered by some that photography would ease out portraiture, which goes back, of course, so far, goes back to the Greek and Roman funerary portraits and goes back to so many of the old masters, and hasn't proven to be so, but at least when there's a royal portrait, there's interest, there's a lot of publicity about it, and also there are different views. I have to say that it's not been hung here, but Lucian Freud's portrait of the Queen, contrast that with the 1953 Annie Goni, where you had this romantic conception of a monarch who appeared to be, as it were, at the beginning of a new Elizabethan age. And here you saw a tiny work, very strong brush strokes. But the more I looked at it, the more I looked at Freud's other work, especially when he had got older, I saw it as an autobiographical portrait, not a portrait of the Queen, as she was at the Golden Jubilee, despite the 1990s, which was so difficult for the monarchy. The Queen Mother had died. We'd seen the popular response to that. And the Queen, she looked like Atlas in this work, yes, as though the world were on her shoulders. Because it was Freud, the critics were favourable, but the public didn't like it, and I didn't feel it captured her character at that time.
It's a very interesting comparison between those two portraits that you've drawn, and I think there's a middle way one as well, which you mentioned at first Anigoni, the second Anigoni painting, which the gallery acquired in 1969. She could be seen, although she doesn't seem to have the world on her shoulders so much, she is in a rather bleak, barren landscape, isn't she? Also Beckettian sort of...
post-nuclear.
Arid, post-nuclear. But she's there in the same sort of full-length pose as the sort of garter one that she had in the 50s, but with the much more sylvan background of the trees and the sort of lovely pastoral idyll. But it's a much starker image, and she's looking, as a monarch should, of the queen of all she surveys, but she does look vulnerable, I think, and she does have this sense of perhaps... loneliness as well, which is sort of perhaps the halfway point to where Freud was. Well,
there is, of course, the classic loneliness of the long-distance monarch, but I won't go there. I feel as though we've travelled through time. I mean, I'm unconscious time is of the essence. But
look at BP then.
Yes. Richard, you have a key point to make.
Well, yes, it's just that it just happens where we're standing. The hanging of works in this gallery is particularly interesting, but it's also very funny at the moment because we've got James the First. We look on our right in a gigantic frame, looking rather like a biblical old drunk, and then on the other side of the gallery, the two portraits face each other, about three galleries hence. We have Charles II, and I think the description goes, I think he fathered, was it 14? How many illegitimate children?
Oh, yes, I'm not sure, but quite a few.
But there you've got the liberty, the personification of a liberty in both these portraits, in my view, do what a portrait should. They don't flatter, they give you the truth.
Yeah.
Well, we've been through our little time machine and moved through the history of the country. We're now actually in the up-to-date section, I think, Ed, of the gallery. It's the BP sequence. And would you like to describe what we're looking at as we wait for Sarah and Demeter? Come along.
We've kind of moved forward so quickly to the people now standing in the forest wearing a hoodie, looking quite relaxed. So the whole gentleman over there wearing a vest. I'm talking about the portraits here, not the visitors. And yes...
Absolutely. Okay. We'll find out a little bit more about what Emma and Sarah seems to be quite enraptured with the photograph the portrait, getting the views that she's currently looking through. We've gone very up to date now. We've moved through that time zone. We've passed through centuries, and as Ed has just said, we've even got people wearing hoodies.
Yes, so here we are in the BP Portrait Award exhibition, which we talked about, and this is where you can come if you want to see the very latest portraiture, in all its variety, a variety of styles, variety of sitters, young and old, international. It's important to say it's an international exhibition. Anybody can enter. It's judged anonymously, of course. So, you know, you can get people who are established artists and you can get people who are painting portraits for the first time. So it's a huge range.
Of course, Richard, you look after the publicity and press for aspects of this, I believe. Was it another one?
I'm so sorry.
You look after some of the press and publicity with this?
In fact, not
for this one.
it's the Royal Society of Portrait Painters. But
fine.
But the point I would make about this show is it's so important how this has evolved over the years. It used to be restricted to younger artists. Now anybody can enter. It's gone international, which gives us an idea not only of the strength of portraiture in other countries, but also there's, you know, you're comparing it when you've got to choose about, 70 works, something like that, out of a vast number, over 2,000, as I remember, being submitted. What is particularly fascinating is this is portraiture reflecting current trends, the styles of the moment, the fact it attracts. Look at the audience around.
That's the reason we've invited our trendsetter Emma Tinson to comment, Emma.
I'm really liking all of the stuff in this part of the gallery, actually. I find it very interesting that where we've looked at the royal archaic pictures upstairs to come down to this more modern area and where there's not a set trend and style of the portraits. So do you think that's quite a good thing to have a more of a relaxed style to them?
Well, I think it's absolutely essential because there's a real danger. I mean, it's important to look historically back to the early portraits, and also, as I think Neil's been stressing, so important to have a chronological hanging so that schools, for example, can benefit enormously, so that we can see our history reflected in portraiture. But the moment people feel that it's something that is so dead today, that it's something that belongs to a past era, then of course it's defunct. And this is the very reverse, and what we see here is a triumphant celebration of diversity. Mm. And what is so fascinating too is that you've got so many different styles. I would hate to be a judge. I have to say that there is one very, very interesting difference between this exhibition and the one I promote, the Rosati Portrait Painters, and that is that I happen to agree with the VP on this. They favour, and indeed the shortlist overall, several years recently, has favoured photorealism, and they give great prominence to it in the exhibition, whereas we have not tended to do so. But I think that's very healthy, and it's the complete mix of styles and of subjects. Indeed, you could say, and I put this to you, that if there's an unusual subject, or if there's a sitter who's captured in a particularly unusual way through a mirror or whatever, or they have tattoos or they're punks or what have you, it seems to me it has a better chance of being hung.
Yes. I mean, you could say that there are themes that come through in the exhibition from year to year that might be tattoos or, you know, but there's always, as you say, unusual things about the composition. If we look behind us there, look at that, there's a picture which is almost verging on abstract shapes at the bottom, but the figure is sort of seen from above, so looking down, and she's pushed into the right hand side of the canvas, so you get a move away from, as you say, a lot of the traditional forms of portraits that we've been seeing in the earlier parts of the collection.
I noticed that this competition, some of the submissions were international ones. Do you find that the international artists have a different style?
Yes, very much so, and you also get, I think, a lot of the entries here, there's connections with the Florence School, isn't it? I've forgotten the name. The Cecil, is it the Rhodes? The Rhodes or the Cecil, I can't remember the name of the school, but it's a school that's very influenced by the John Singer Sargent type of technique. And we mentioned Nicky Phillips being an artist, perhaps as a proponent of that technique. And so there are a lot of paintings.
Cutting edge, I think, is the phrase we're looking for.
Well, there are paintings of that school, and then there are there's a Spanish, very strong Spanish contingent this year.
Welcome, because the standard is so high. Yes. And also, they take inspiration. I mean, we've got Goya and Velázquez, for example. But, Alex, I have to say, it's just behind you. That must be one of the most extraordinary portraits in the entire gallery, where, in fact, you have a person lying full length upon the floor, but with his head turned away from us.
He's simply looking to read the thing on the bottom of the lining. That's all, Richard. It's just a new pose by a museum.
No, but it's a wonderful example, because I do think it's an important question about international portraiture, because in the United States, portraiture is not so recognised as here, and of course Cindy Sherman, but then she subverts the genre. The New York, I saw her exhibition. There are certain American artists exhibited here, aren't there? But which of the foreign contingent is the most numerous?
This year, I think it would be the Spanish, actually. I think we've had the highest from Spain.
Presumably their connection with Shakespeare. I won't go. Yeah.
But, I mean, it's interesting that if you go round this exhibition, what I found this year, that, yes, there's a lot of modernism, postmodernism, and diversity, but there are also great classical Western art references, aren't there? And we're looking at this portrait that we've talked about before, with this gentleman lying on the floor. It reminds me of the famous, is it the Holbein long picture of the corpse of Christ in a very very narrow canvas, squashed into the coffin or into, you know. And I just wonder, you know, you can go look at lots of these paintings and see echoes of famous Western paintings as well, which I think is wonderful.
Almost post-postmodernism, really.
Yes. Yeah. But this is so tremendously important, because what we're keeping alive here, I think, is the craft. One of the problems, and I do think this is a real difficulty for art students, is the vast majority, but by no means, happily, this does not apply to all, schools do not teach what could be called the basics or skills. I think that's essential to learn that, like so many of the great impressionists and early modern contemporary painters learnt it, and then you branch off and do whatever you like. But here you do see, and I think that's so significant, the tradition to past centuries reflected
absolutely.
I'm conscious, Neil, that we've possibly taken 3,600 seconds to fit in centuries of work. Emma, any final thoughts from yourself?
I'm really impressed with the whole gallery. I haven't been here before, and to see the such range of artwork as well coming through all the years, and the contrast, I think, between the old and the new is really interesting to see.
We'll just get final thoughts as well from Ed and Sarah, who are just actually behind at present. Richard, whilst you're there, sorry.
My favourite okay. work.
Sometimes you just cannot refuse him, Neil, can you? He's just sort of through as we follow Richard to his favourite sort of piece from that. Actually, whilst we're there, Ed, your closing thoughts on what we've seen today.
I've got burning questions about why somebody's graffiti on their wrist is written the wrong way up, and I hate to think that almost somebody's penned it on once it's in the gallery. That's my burning question. No, surely not. That would be awful, wouldn't it?
That would not be at all appropriate. But this is apparently Richard's favourite one from that point of view. And you're going for?
Well, I am going for Eliza by Michael Gaskill. And I'm delighted to say this did win the second prize, so it nearly made it to the top. And what I like so much about this work is that it has a certain purity, it has a depth. The inspiration it draws from the early Dutch portraits, I think enriches it so. I think the colouring is beautiful, and what it has an echo of is The Girl with the Pearl Earring, the famous work at the Mauritshuis, which of course was the subject of the film by Scarlett Johansson, and I find it absolutely exquisite.
Exactly. Of course, these days, Richard, it's ScarJo as opposed to Scarlett Johansson, just a minor one. Final closing thoughts. Actually, Richard, your final closing thoughts on the piece today.
Well, I'm so glad we've come to this gallery because... Well,
thanks to Neil. He could have said no.
Indeed, thanks to Neil. But also, I mean, the way the National Portrait Gallery has expanded in recent decades, the way it's changed, but also the way it's kept important traditions alive, and the way it has drawn in audiences so that they appreciate what's best about modern portraiture, that they've got a chance of looking chronologically at our history, and also that they've diversified into exhibitions of photography and such a vast number of things, I think shows tremendous credit.
Thumbs up from yourself, Richard. Thumbs of course, last up. Year we were at the National Youth Theatre, and National Theatre, of course, we were also covered the Grand National. I think the National Portrait Gallery is well up there. Ed, your closing thoughts.
I'm educated, and thank you, Neil, for showing us around. It's really been a great, thank you.
As a musician, that's a genuine delight to touch base with a good self. He said genuine three times now, amazing. And I'm sure that the National Portrait Gallery will continue to go from strength to strength. I think Sarah Huntley, we've lost her.
I don't know where she's gone. She's clearly absorbing all the artwork.
Soaking the thing in. Neil, we've thoroughly enjoyed this little audio promenade. Hopefully it hasn't been too trotty for yourself.
My pleasure. It seemed lovely to have you. And
hopefully we'll speak back again very soon.
Great. Thank you very much. Lovely to see you.
Well, we've located Sarah Huntley. She's found us again. Sarah, your thoughts on the experience today?
Well, just so thought-provoking and happy, sad, and every picture tells a story.
Much like an average Midweek Drive or Media Matters programme, really.
Absolutely.
If you're listening to the Midweek Drive on location with Siren FM, and of course that's our broadcasting association with multivits.co.uk, and the fabulous team that has been comprised of Ed Wellman.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you.
Sarah Huntley.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Emma Timpson.
Thank you very much.
Neil, who is actually sort of... he's coming back in a few seconds. That's great. Neil Evans, without whom the whole thing would not have been possible. And indeed, your good self, Richard Fitzwilliams.
It's been terrific fun. I hope we can do something like this again very soon.